An Osho Talk.
God is dead. Now Zen is the only living truth.
Number 2.
When Sukhito received the precepts, his master, Seigen, asked him, "Now you have received the precepts, you want to learn the Vinaya, don't you?" Sukhito replied, "There's no need to learn the Vinaya." Seigen asked, "Then you want to read the Book of Sila?" Sukhito replied, "There's no need to read the Book of Sila." Seigen asked, "Can you deliver a letter to Nangaku Osho?" Sukhito said, "Certainly." Seigen said, "Go now and come back quickly. If you come back even a little late, you will miss me. If you miss me, you cannot get the big hatchet under my chair." Soon Sukhito reached Nangaku. Before handing over the letter, Sukhito made a bow and asked, "Osho, when one neither follows the old saints nor expresses one's innermost soul, what will one do?" Nangaku said, "Your question is too arrogant. Why don't you ask modestly?" To which Sukhito replied, "Then it would be better to sink into hell eternally and not ever hope for the liberation that the old saints know." Sukhito, finding that he and Nangaku were not attuned to each other, soon left for Seigen without giving Nangaku the letter. On his arrival, Seigen asked, "Did they entrust something to you?" Sukhito said, "They didn't entrust anything to me." Seigen said, "But there must have been a reply." Sukhito said, "If they don't entrust anything, there is no reply." Then he said, "When I was leaving here, you added that I should come back soon to receive the big hatchet under the chair. Now I have come back. Please give me the big hatchet." Seigen was silent. Sukhito bowed down and retired.
Friends, before I answer your questions, I have to answer two letters by very knowledgeable idiots.
This distinction has to be remembered. There is a certain ignorance that knows, and there is a certain knowledgeability that knows nothing. One is a Buddhist scholar, and he writes that an enlightened man cannot be concerned with the trivia. Of ordinary world and its concerns. It means, according to him, I am an ignorant man. It is a compliment to me, because every enlightened man finally becomes as ignorant as a child or as innocent as a child. Socrates' last words were, "I don't know anything." This man is a scholar but blind. Does he think that a third world war is a trivia which is going to erase the whole humanity? Does he think that the explosion of population in this country is trivia, which is going to kill almost 500 million people in the coming 10 years? And if these are trivia, then I have to take him back towards Gautam Buddha. He was concerned that no sannyasin of his should have more than 3 pieces of clothes. That was trivia. He was concerned that no sannyasin of his should wear shoes. That is trivia. He was concerned that no sannyasin should eat more than 1 time in a day. That was trivia. And still he is enlightened, and I am ignorant. This is how I call knowledgeable idiots. Buddha has made 33 million rules for his disciples, all trivia. Where can you find 33 million truths? Truth is one and unexpressible. But he was concerned with absolute trivia. One sannyasin is going to spread his message, and he has come for his last word, because he may not be coming for 2 years or 3 years back to him. And what is his message? Don't see a woman. Now, unless you see, you cannot decide whether the person is a woman or a man. I don't understand what kind of nonsense Buddha is talking. How you are going to know that the person coming towards you is a woman? You have to see first, then you can close your eyes, but you have seen. And once you have seen a beautiful woman and you close your eyes, she becomes more beautiful. Is it not trivia? And Buddha told him that you have to keep your eyes just 4 feet ahead of you. Just look only 4 feet and keep your eyes down. So even if you come across a woman, you only see her feet. This is great spiritual stuff. And the man was a little puzzled. He said, "I will try my best. But if by chance I happen to see a woman accidentally, suddenly a woman comes from out of the forest or on a crossroads, what should I do?" Buddha said, "If you accidentally see a woman, don't talk to her." Is it great spirituality? Don't say even a hello. because she is a woman. And the man insisted that he said, if the woman says something, will not be it embarrassing not to answer her? Will it not be inhuman? Buddha said, if such a coincidence happens, you can talk to her, but don't touch her. Is this spiritual stuff? What do you call trivia? The whole humanity is going to die and I should not speak. And your Gautama Buddha is talking absolute nonsense to the people. And the man was intelligent enough. He said, there may be a situation in which I have to touch a woman. Perhaps a woman has fallen in a well. What I am supposed to do? Or in a ditch? What I am supposed to do? Should I just go on without looking at her miserable state? Without helping her? And Buddha said, if such a coincidence happens, you can touch. But remember, all that is outside is illusory. If it is illusory, then why the fuss? The woman is illusory and don't touch her. What is the problem if you touch an illusion? Don't talk to the illusion. Don't look at the illusion. This I call absolute trivia. These Buddhist scholars are going to provoke me. I will pull down Gautama Buddha completely. And my concern for humanity makes me ignorant. And his concern about women and about clothes and about shoes and about not touching women, not looking more than 4 feet ahead, makes him enlightened. His enlightenment is rotten. It is a bullock cart enlightenment. I am a contemporary man, 25 centuries ahead of Gautama Buddha. He is just an old hat. But these Buddhist scholars are provoking me. I will start talking about Gautama Buddha and pull down the whole house that he has built. Because it is built on all stupid things. My concern with humanity is absolutely spiritual. And my concern for this beautiful planet is sacred. It is my compassion and my love. And I don't care about any Gautama Buddha. I am a Buddha in my own right. And your old Buddha is too out of date. I belong to my time. And I speak the language of my time. Buddha was afraid to allow women in his commune. For 20 years continuously he refused women. What was the fear? He was not trusting his own sannyasins. This was distrust. A master distrusting his own people? He was afraid that if women enter into the commune, then what will happen to the celibacy of the monks? But if their celibacy is so thin that the entry of the woman is going to disturb their celibacy, it is not much of a celibacy. They must have been homosexuals, as we are finding now in every monastery around the world. All kinds of sexual perversions are practiced. It cannot be otherwise to the Buddha's disciples. Only my people are living a natural, sacred, existential life. Not against the current, not against the universe. And without listening me, without reading me, these idiots go on making their comments. My whole effort is to bring materialism and spiritualism in a balance. To me, the outside world is as real as the inside world. So naturally it creates trouble for me from both the sides. The communists have written books against me for the reason that I am teaching spirituality, meditation, and diverting people from their real concern, that is a classless society. And I am making people selfish because I am just telling them to go in. And the spiritualists are against me, and they have written books against me and articles, and every day there are letters. Their problem is that I am taking too much interest in the world. A man of real spirituality should close his eyes, because the world is illusory. But no one of your so-called and self-styled enlightened people have taken the trouble to think twice. When you say the world is illusory, then there is no need to renounce it. Nobody renounces dreams. Do you renounce your dream when you wake up in the morning? Dream is just a dream. There is no question of renouncing it. And if you are having a sweet dream, I will say, enjoy it. Make this whole world a sweet dream, not a nightmare. All your politicians and all your priests are trying to make it a nightmare. Then naturally people think to renounce it. It is such a tragedy. But I am not in favor of renouncing the world. And I don't say that the world is illusory. Otherwise, why Buddha goes on begging every day? If the world is illusory, where are you going? To beg before an illusory house? And a woman gives you food and she is illusory and the food is real. Why you need 3 pieces of clothes? This was the criticism of Mahavira, a Buddha's contemporary, who lived naked. He did not accept Buddha as enlightened, because he is not living naked. 3 pieces of clothes was luxury to Mahavira. A man who was living naked in summer, in winter, in rain, naturally, he has the right to say to Buddha that you are living in great luxury. 3 pieces of clothes. You are too much materialistic. Buddha was eating 1 meal a day. To Mahavira, that was luxury. In his 12 years before he became enlightened, he ate only 365 days. In 12 years, he ate only 1 year. Not continuously. 2 months fast and 1 day he will eat. 3 months fast and 1 day he will eat. So it comes nearly in 12 years, 1 year. That means after 11 days, 1 day he was eating average. Of course, to him, Buddha is indulging in luxury. These are relative terms. And Buddha was criticizing Mahavira on such trivial things because he could not find answers for Mahavira's criticism that you are living in luxury, daily food, 3 pieces of clothes. He found another way to criticize him. Because the followers of Mahavira were telling that Mahavira is omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient, all the qualities of God. And Buddha was laughing at Mahavira, telling to his disciples that this fellow, this guy, says that he is omniscient, all-knowing, and I know him. Once he was begging before a house in which nobody lives. And he talks about knowing everything, past, present, future, and he does not know that the house is empty. There is nobody. For years it has been empty. And this man is omniscient. And one day he was passing early in the morning, going to the river, and he stamped over a tail of a dog who was fast asleep on the road. When the dog started barking, then he realized. And this man is omniscient, all-knowing, and he does not know that the dog is lying just in front of him. Do you think these criticisms are very spiritual? Neither Mahavira's criticism are very spiritual, neither Buddha's criticism are very spiritual, just trivia. So I want to tell this Buddhist scholar, consider again who is enlightened. The other is also a Buddhist scholar. And he says, I have been reading your books on Buddha and I have appreciated them very much. But he never wrote any letter to me or any letter to the newspapers. Now he has published his letter in the newspapers. Now he says, it is a strange thing. When I was saying things in appreciation, nobody ever wrote a single word. They thought what I was saying is really the meaning of Buddha's sutras. It was not. The meaning was given by me, and I can take it away. And tore down all your scriptures, point by point. Now he says that I cannot have samadhi, enlightenment, because I don't have seal, I have only prajna. He does not understand at all, neither Buddha nor me. Prajna is a byproduct of samadhi, of enlightenment. Prajna means wisdom. Unless you become enlightened, you cannot have wisdom. You can have only knowledge. And prajna does not mean knowledge, it means wisdom. It is a byproduct of samadhi, enlightenment. But he has no experience of samadhi, just has seen the scriptures. And you will see in the coming sutra an authentic seeker simply denies that what he has to do with shield. Shield means character. Now he is concerned with my character. That without character, you cannot become enlightened. What he knows about my character? And have you ever thought about the character of Buddha? For 29 years continuously, he was indulging in sex, not only with his wife, he had many concubines. His father was told when he was born that either he will become a world emperor or he will renounce the world and become an enlightened one. These are the two alternatives. Of course, the father wanted him to become the world emperor. So he asked how to prevent him from becoming enlightened. I want him to become the world emperor. He was a small king in a small kingdom. Just Arun from Nepal has brought the palace, which is in ruins where Buddha was born. Even in ruins you can see the kingdom was not great. The palace looks just an ordinary big house. And it was a small village. On the border of Nepal and India. Naturally, the father must have the ambition of becoming a great world conqueror. He was hoping Buddha will become a world conqueror. And the astrologer suggested that if you want him to be prevented from enlightenment, then make every comfort and luxury possible for him. He should grow up in luxury, indulgence. He should not see anybody old, anybody dead. Even the flowers which are going to fall down should be removed before he sees. All pale leaves which are going to fall should be removed, and he should be made to live in different palaces in different seasons. So he never comes to feel any season is a trouble. So three palaces were made in different places, one for the summer, one for the winter, one for the rain. And great gardens were created around the palaces. And his father collected all the beautiful girls from his kingdom. They were his concubines. He was surrounded with women, music, wine. For 29 years, and he has a wife and a son, and he can become enlightened. I don't have a son, I don't have a wife, I don't have concubines, I don't have even a girlfriend. And I don't have character, and Buddha has character. No man has indulged more than Gautam Buddha. What character? When he became enlightened, he used to have 5 disciples before his enlightenment. They were disciples because he was an ascetic. He was torturing himself, fasting, and he had become just a skeleton. And these 5 disciples were immensely impressed by his self-torture. The whole humanity lives in this idea. If you torture yourself, you are a saint. The day he became enlightened, he dropped all self-torture. It was absolutely useless. All his 5 disciples left him immediately that he has fallen from saintliness. He has become enlightened. And those 5 disciples who have been with him for many years, respecting him as a great saint, just left him that he has fallen. He has started eating. He has started having warm clothes. Perhaps these Buddhist scholars don't understand at all, except the scriptures. Character arises out of enlightenment. It is not vice versa. It is not character that produces enlightenment. Otherwise, enlightenment will be having a cause to it. Enlightenment is your nature. It has no cause. It is already there. Just you have to discover it. It does not matter what kind of character you have. If you go inwards, the sinner will find the Buddha just as much as the saint. And only after you have found your enlightenment, the radiation of the enlightenment becomes your character, your seal. Your enlightenment becomes your innocence. And out of that innocence arises wisdom. But wisdom is not knowledge. It is simply transparent clarity about everything, inner or outer. But these knowledgeable idiots simply prove one thing that I have been continuously telling to you. Don't get involved in scholarship. Don't get involved in knowledgeability. That is the greatest barrier in enlightenment. Because you are so full of knowledge, and all knowledge is of the mind, and enlightenment is not of the mind. It is the fragrance of no mind. And the no mind is not based on any character. Just the contrary, all character arises out of the clarity of no mind. So it is not imposed from outside as a discipline. It arises as a spontaneous response. You simply cannot do any evil. It is not a question of your deciding not to do evil. You simply cannot do. You are so full of light. How can you behave like a blind man? You are so full of light, how can you behave like a man in darkness stumbling? So character arises, wisdom arises, and thousand more things, blissfulness, ecstasy, benediction, compassion, and there is no end. More and more flowers go on flowering. But this is the difficulty of the knowledgeable person. He has accepted a certain fixed formula. I want you to know absolutely clearly that just as everything goes on expanding and growing, even enlightenment becomes more clearer, more deeper, more higher as time passes by. After 25 centuries, I am not going to be a replica of Gautama Buddha. I have nothing to learn from him. If anything has to be, he has to learn something from me. 25 centuries have not been a mere wastage. Just as everything is progressing and evolving, so is the consciousness. But every scholar gets completely fucked up. Then he thinks only in terms of his scripture, and the scripture is 25 centuries old, and I am a contemporary man, and I am not belonging to any category. I am a category in myself. I decide according to my spontaneous response, not according to any commandments, not according to any discipline, whether the discipline is given by Buddha or Mahavira or Christ or Krishna, it does not matter. They are all old. But these people are living in the past. I am moving moment to moment in the future. I have left Gautama Buddha 25 centuries behind, and his enlightenment also is 25 centuries old. So much dust has gathered on it, but my mirror of consciousness is absolutely fresh. And I am not going to listen to anybody. Nobody is my master. And nobody has the right to tell me what is character and what is wisdom and what is enlightenment. Nobody has that right. I am a man absolutely free. I live my life according to my own light. I am nobody's follower, and I don't live my life according to any scripture. These idiots should shut up. Because of them, they will provoke me to condemn Buddha and Mahavira and Krishna and everybody. And they won't have any argument against me. Now, what these people can say, that Buddha was not concerned with trivia. He was concerned. And my concern is not trivia. My concern is a third world war that is hanging just on the horizon, any moment. And there will be no life on the earth and no possibility of any Buddha. And you call it trivia? Beware of the scholars. They are the most idiotic people in the world. Your questions. First question. God is dead. But what that creates the question, who began this universe? There is no need for anybody to begin it, because there is no beginning to this universe and there is no end. This question has been exploited by all the religions, because everybody wants to know who began the universe. Because your minds are so small, they cannot conceive a beginningless universe, an endless universe, just eternity to eternity. Because you cannot conceive that vastness, your question arises, who created the universe? Who began it? But if there was somebody already to begin it, there was universe. Do you see the simple arithmetic? If there was somebody already to begin it, then you cannot call it beginning. Somebody was already there. If you think that God is a necessary thing, it gives you consolation that God created the world, so you have a beginning. But who created God? Again you fall in the same problem. And all the religions have said that God exists eternally. There is no creator of God. If that is true for God, why it is not true for existence itself? It is autonomous. It exists on its own. There is no need of any creator, because that creator will require another creator, and you will fall into an absurd regress. You can go from A to Z, but who created Z? The question remains standing, you simply go on pushing. But the question is not solved, because you have asked a wrong question. The universe has no beginning, it is not a creation by anybody, it has no end. And remember, if it has any beginning, then there will be certainly an end. Every beginning is a beginning of an end. Every birth is the beginning of death. So it is good, get rid of God. Because if He can create the world, He can destroy the world. And any world that is created is bound to be destroyed sooner or later. If there is birth, there is death. Only a beginningless universe can be endless. So your problem is just because the capacity of the mind is very limited. That's why I want you to go beyond mind. Only no mind can conceive the beginningless, the endless, the incomprehensible becomes absolutely clear. There is no problem at all. Those who have risen beyond mind have also risen beyond God. Simultaneously, God is a need for the mind, because the mind cannot conceive infinite, eternal things. It can only conceive very limited things. The question arises because of your mind's incapacity, its impotence. You ask, God is dead, but that creates the question. Who began this universe? But have you ever thought that God will not solve the question? On the contrary, the question will be posed a step back. Who created God? Any hypothesis that does not destroy the question is absolutely useless. Any answer that keeps on pushing the question further back but does not touch it at all is not the answer. The only answer you will find is in your own experience of eternity. Then you will know nobody has created it. It has no beginning, no end. You don't have any beginning, you don't have any end. When you experience it within your own self, you know existence is autonomous. It is not created. A created thing cannot be more than a mechanism. It cannot be organic reality. A car is created. Man is not created. If man is also created, he becomes a mechanism, a robot. You can dismantle a car, take all the parts apart, the wheel and everything, and you can put them back, and the car will be perfectly okay. But cut a man into pieces and then join them together with German glue, still the man will not be back. An organic phenomenon cannot be dissected. The moment you dissect it, its very mystery disappears. Then you can join those parts. But you will have only a corpse, not a living human being. It is the dignity of existence that it is not created. It is the dignity of man that he is not created. God is an insult to existence, to man, to consciousness, to everything. God is a humiliation. God is not a solution for any problem. In fact, He creates more problems in the world and He does not solve anything. There are 300 religions in the world and all are fighting with each other. And these are all created because of the concept of God, because they all have invented their own concepts. The Hindu God has three heads. Just think of the poor fellow. Imagine you are having three heads. I don't think you will be able to stand up. One head will be falling this side, one head will be falling that side, this head will be falling this side. The very weight. Because I have seen the statues and the pictures of Hindu God, His whole body seems to be just like a man. It cannot. Man is three heads. I have seen children in circuses which are freaks of nature. I have seen children having two heads, but they cannot even sit. They are just lying down. The circus is enjoying their tragedy, earning money. One man had gone to see a circus and there was a three-headed child in the circus. And the man was very much concerned because all his children, and he has 20 children, 4 wives. He was a Mohammedan. The fee was 1 rupee per person. And every child of his was insisting to see. There was great trouble. The father was trying to convince them that we don't have 20 rupees. I can remain out and I can send you, but we don't have 20 rupees. The owner of the child, who was distributing tickets, heard all this argument between the children and the father. He said, "Wait, I will give you 20 rupees. Let me bring the child with three heads. He can see. You are a bigger phenomenon, one man with 20 children. And he brought the child in a trolley to look at this man who has 20 children. And he gave him 20 rupees as a fee. Because this boy also needs some entertainment. He is giving entertainment to thousands of people. But that boy could not see from all his three faces and 6 eyes. It was difficult for him even to turn into the trolley. Hindu God must be living in a trolley. And one head will always be pushing against the pillow. Breathing will be difficult. And walking is out of question. And all three gods, which have one body, have three wives. Just see the tragedy. Each god is joined with two other gods, and each god has a separate wife. Three wives to one man, because the sexual machinery is only one. I have never heard that the Indian God has three sexual machineries. Now, I cannot figure it out how things are managed. These fictions create 300 religions because everybody is free to have his own fiction. Why borrow anybody's other's fiction? There are religions which think that God has 1,000 hands. They must be growing all over the body, just like branches in a tree. And I don't think he can manage to do anything. From the back they will be growing backwards, from the front they will be growing. There is no space left for anything else. And there are gods which have 1,000 eyes. I cannot conceive. Even with no mind, I cannot conceive. Then there is no possibility for ears, no possibility for the nose, no possibility for the mouth, no possibility for anything. Not even hairs. He must be bald-headed. Eyes all over the head. Even then I don't think you can manage 1,000 eyes. And how he will move? According to which eye he will see? Even if he winks at a woman, which eye? 1,000 eyes winking at one woman. That will be real romance. God has not solved any problem, God has created thousands of problems. And every religion has its own idea. Because it is a fiction. You don't have different ideas about the sun. You don't have different ideas about the rose. You can have only different ideas about a fiction. It is up to you. Whichever way you want. The Bible says God created man in his own image. The reality is just the opposite. Man has created God in his own image. And he has been trying to refine the image of God, finding explanations for all kind of absurdities. He needs 1,000 hands because he has to care about 5 billion people. But if you have to care about 5 billion people, you need 5 billion hands. 1,000 hands won't do. At least, if you want even to shake hands with the whole humanity, you will need 5 billion hands, just hands and nothing else. And you go on shaking and nobody is there. They go on finding explanations because he has to look after the whole universe, that's why he has 1,000 eyes. Can't he move his head just the way I am moving? And I can see 10,000 people without any difficulty, just with 2 eyes. Does not he move backwards and go reverse. He has eyes all over his head, so when he wants to go backwards, front eyes are closed, backward eyes are open. When he wants sideways, three sides are closed, right side is open. Is it a god or some kind of toy to entertain children? The very idea of God is just because our mind cannot comprehend the eternity. Once you rise beyond your limited mind to an unlimited, no mind, you can conceive all that was inconceivable before. No God is needed. The second question, is there any place for prayer in religion if there is no God? There is no place for prayer, because prayer is God-oriented. If there is no God, whom you can pray? And all prayers are false because there is nobody to answer them, nobody to hear them. All prayers are humiliation, insult, degradation. All prayers are disgusting. You are kneeling down to a fiction which does not exist. And you are, what you are doing in your prayers, begging, give me this, give me that. Utter beggarly, God, give me my daily bread. Can't you ask once for all? Every day? And 5 billion people asking, and only one person listening, do you think he will remain sane? Give me daily bread. Why not ask for the whole life and be finished? One prayer will do. But every day bothering him, nagging him like a wife, morning and evening, and there are Mohammedans who do 5 prayers a day. They are the great naggers. I used to go to take meditation camps to Udaipur. It was a long journey from the place I used to live, Jabalpur. 36 hours, because there was no plane at that time in Jabalpur. There was an airport, but it was a military airport, and they were not allowing to open it for the public. Now it is opened. So I had to go in a train and change many junctions. First I will have to change at Katni, then I will have to change at Bina, then I will have to change at Agra, and then I will have to go on changing at Chittorgarh, and finally I will reach to Udaipur. At Chittorgarh, it was evening time when the train reached. And Ajmer is very close to Chittorgarh. Ajmer is one of the strongholds of Mohammedans. So in the train there were many Mohammedans, and the train was to stay for 1 hour for some other train to come, who was bringing passengers for this train also to go towards Udaipur. So for 1 hour I used to walk on the platform, and all the Mohammedans lined on the platform were sitting in prayer, and I was enjoying them. I will just go near somebody and say, the train is leaving, and he will just jump up. And then he will be angry at me that you disturbed my prayer. I said, I do not disturb anybody's prayer. I am simply doing my prayer. This is my heartfelt desire that the train should leave. I was not talking to you. I don't know even your name. He will say, this is strange. In the middle of my prayer, I said, it was not prayer, because I was seeing you have been looking again and again at the train. He said, that is true. And it was all over the platform. So I will go few people ahead and just whisper, the train is leaving. And again another person will jump up and will be very angry that, what kind of person you are? You look religious and you disturb people in their prayer. I said, I am not disturbing anybody. I am just praying to God that the train should be leaving now. What are your prayers? Begging this, begging that, your prayer reduces you into a beggar. Meditation transforms you into an emperor. And there is nobody to hear your prayers. There is nobody to answer your prayers. But all religions go on making you extrovert so that you don't turn inwards. Prayer is an extrovert thing. The God is there and you are shouting to that God. But it is taking you away from yourself. Every prayer is irreligious. I have told you the beautiful story by Leo Tolstoy. The Archbishop of the old Orthodox Church of Russia, it is a story before the revolution, became very much worried that many people of his congregation are going towards a lake, and there are 3 villagers on a small island in the lake, and they sit under a tree, and thousands of people are going thinking they are saints. In Christianity, you cannot be a saint on your own. The word saint comes from sanction. You have to be sanctioned by the church that you are a saint. It is a certificate. It is so ugly an idea that the church will give you a certificate that you are a saint. Even a man like Francis of Assisi, a beautiful man, was called by the Pope that people have started worshipping you like a saint. and you don't have any certificate. And that's where I feel Francis missed the point. He should have refused, but he knelt just like a Christian and asked the Pope, give me the certificate. Otherwise he was a nice man, beautiful man, but I don't mention his name because he acted in a very stupid way. This is not the way of a saint. I don't need anybody's certificate for my enlightenment or for my Buddhahood. I declare it. I don't need anybody's certificate. Who can give me the certificate? Even Gautam Buddha cannot give me the certificate. Who has given him certificate? But the idea of saint in English is very wrong. It comes from sanctus. So the Archbishop of Russia was very angry that who are these saints? I have never certified anybody in years. Suddenly from where these saints have arrived? But people were going and the church was becoming more and more empty every day. Finally he decided to go and see who are these people. So he took a motor boat, went to the isle, and those three villagers, they were villagers, uneducated, simple people, utterly innocent. And the Archbishop was a powerful man. Next to Tsar, he was the most powerful man in Russia. He was very angry at those three villagers and told them that, who made you saints? They looked at each other. They said, nobody. And we don't think we are saints, we are poor people. But why so many people are coming here? They said, you have to ask them. He said, do you know the Orthodox prayer of the church? They said, we are uneducated in the prayer too long. We cannot remember it. So what prayer you do? They all looked at each other. You tell him. The other said, you tell him. They were feeling embarrassed because... But the Archbishop became more and more arrogant, seeing that these are absolute idiots. They don't know even the prayer. How they can be the saints? So he said, anybody can tell, just tell it. They said, we are feeling very embarrassed because we have made our own prayer, not knowing the authorized prayer by the church. We have made our own prayer, very simple it is. Please forgive us that we did not ask your permission, but we were feeling so embarrassed we did not come. Our prayer is, God is three, we are also three. So we have made a prayer, you are three and we are three, have mercy on us. This is our prayer. The Archbishop was very angry that this is no prayer. I have never heard this kind of thing. He started laughing. Those poor fellows said, you teach us what is the real prayer. We thought it is perfectly right. God is three, we are three, and what more has to be needed? Just have mercy on us. So he told them the Orthodox prayer, which was a long prayer. By the time he has ended, they said, we have forgotten the beginning. So he told the beginning again, then he said, we have forgotten the end. The archbishop was getting angry and irritated. He said, "What kind of people you are? Can't you remember a simple prayer?" He said, "It is too long and we are uneducated and such big words. We cannot. You just be patient with us. If you repeat it 2-3 times, perhaps we may get the knack of it." So he repeated 3 times. They said, "Okay, we will try, but we are afraid that it may not be the complete prayer, some things may be missing, but we will try." The arrogant archbishop was very much satisfied that he has finished these 3 cents and he can tell to his people that those are idiots, "Where are you going?" And he left in the boat. Suddenly he saw that behind his boat those 3 people are running on the water coming. He could not believe his eyes. He rubbed his eyes. By that time they had reached by the side of his boat standing on the water. And they said, "Just 1 time more, we forgot." But seeing the situation, that these people are walking on water and I going in the motorboat, he said, "You continue your prayer. Don't bother about what I have said to you. Just forgive me. I was out of arrogance. Your simpleness, your innocence is your prayer. You just go. You don't need any certificate." But they insisted, "You have come so far. Just 1 time more. We know we will forget it, but 1 time more so we can remember it." But the archbishop said, "I have been repeating that prayer my whole life and it has not been heard. And you are walking on water and we have heard only in the miracles of Jesus that he used to walk on water. This is for the first time I am seeing the miracle. You just go back. Your prayer is perfectly right." The prayer was not the thing because there is nobody to hear it. But their utter innocence and trust. Transformed them into a totally new beings. So fresh, so childlike, just a rose flower opening in the early morning sun with all its beauty. Now that the arrogance was dropped, the archbishop could see their faces, their innocence, their grace, their blissfulness. And they returned back on the waters, running hand in hand, reached to their tree. Leo Tolstoy was refused Nobel Prize on such stories. His name was nominated. The Nobel Prize Committee opens its records after 50 years. In a century, only 1 time. In the middle of the century, it opens its records. So when last time it opened, 1950, researchers rushed to see the records, whose names were nominated and cancelled, and what was the reason? Leo Tolstoy's name was nominated but never given the prize. And the reason was written underneath that he is not an orthodox Christian. He writes such stories, such novels, although he is a Christian, but he is not orthodox Christian. Hence, Nobel Prize cannot be given. But this has never been told to the world, that Nobel Prize exists only for Orthodox Christians. And Leo Tolstoy was one of the most simple-hearted, innocent person, one of the most creative persons the world has ever known. His novels are such a beauty. His life was also very simple. Although he was a count, and his forefathers belonged to the royal family, and he had still a vast palace and thousands of acres of land and thousands of slaves. His wife was very angry with him. The whole life it was a trouble, because he lived like slaves and he worked like slaves in the fields. He was very friendly with the slaves. He slept in their poor huts. He ate their food. And they could not believe. They said that, "Master, you are our owner." He said, "No. We are all sharing. I work with you. I can eat with you. I can sleep here." The wife was really angry. She was a countess, belonged herself to a very rich family, another count family, and she could not believe what kind of man he is. He lives with those dirty people, he eats their food, he goes to work in the field he does not need. And such a simple man, innocent man, creative man, was refused Nobel Prize on the ground that he is not Orthodox Church. He does not belong to the Orthodox line of fanatic Christians. Even I was amazed when I read that statement. So this Nobel Prize is just for Orthodox and fanatic Christians? Politicians? Not for creative artists? You are asking, is there any place for prayer in religion? Not at all. In an authentic religion, meditation has a place but no prayer. Prayer is extrovert, meditation is introvert. Meditation makes you a Buddha, prayer simply makes you a beggar. And prayer is fiction oriented, meditation is truth oriented. Meditation is Zen and prayer is nothing but part and parcel of the fiction called God. Avoid prayers. They are taking you away from your own existential reality. Go deeper into meditation. That is the only religiousness possible. The sutras. When Sekito received the precepts, his masters again asked him, "Now, you have received the precepts. You want to learn the Vinaya, don't you?" Vinaya is one of the scriptures of Gautama Buddha. The whole name is Vinaya Pitak. Again asked Sekito, "You are initiated into sannyas. Now, do you want to learn the scriptures called Vinaya? The word Vinaya means humbleness. It is one of the series of discourses of Buddha. Sekhito replied, there is no need to learn the Vinaya. There is no need to learn the scriptures. Because truth is never found in any scriptures. Truth is not a philosophy or a theology. There is no need. Sekhito was sent to Segen by his master, Ino. He was already right, but because Ino was feeling death is coming too fast, he was very old, and perhaps he will not be able to see the enlightenment of Sekhito, and it is better to send him to a master who can help him in the last stages of his evolution. So he has sent him to Segen, who has been his lifelong competitor. But both recognized each other in their hearts as enlightened. Sekhito is not a beginner. So when Segen asked, would you like to learn the scriptures? He said, there is no need to learn the scriptures. Segen asked, then you want to read the book of Śīla, the book of character? If you don't want to learn scriptures about humbleness, would you like to know about scriptures which deal with character, morality? Śīla means character. This is what the Buddhist scholar has raised the question against me, that without Śīla, how I can become enlightened? Sekhito replied, and this is the reply of a man who was coming very close to enlightenment, there is no need to read the book of Śīla, because all these things will follow enlightenment. They don't proceed, they succeed. Enlightenment contains immense treasures. You just become enlightened and everything follows. You don't have to learn, you don't have to discipline, you don't have to make any effort. Everything is spontaneously following you. You just become the Buddha first. So he said, there is no need to read the book of character and morality. Segen asked, can you deliver a letter to Nangaku Osho? Nangaku was another famous master. And this was just a strategy of Segen. He was trying to figure out where Sekhito is. All these questions are not for any answers. He is trying to figure out the newly arrived person who has lived with a great master, Ino, how far he has reached, how deep he has reached. He is just trying to figure out from every nook and corner so that he can begin with how ripe he is, and how much ripening he needs. So this was another methodology. He failed in asking about the Vinaya scriptures. Sekitu answered exactly as if he is already enlightened. He asked about Shila scriptures and he answered exactly as if he is already enlightened. Then he tried in a different way. He said, "Can you deliver a letter to Nangaku Osho?" Nangaku lived on another mountain monastery nearby. Sekitu said, "Certainly." Segen said, "Go now and come back quickly. If you come back even a little late, you will miss me. If you miss me, you cannot get the big hatchet under my chair." Soon Sekitu reached Nangaku. Before handing over the letter, Sekitu made a bow and asked, "Osho, when one neither follows the old saints nor expresses one's innermost soul, what will one do?" His question is very important. He is saying, with absolute respect, he is saying, "Osho, when one neither follows the old saints nor expresses one's innermost soul, what will one do?" Nangaku said, "Your question is too arrogant. Nobody asks such a question. Immediately you entered into my temple and you started asking me questions. First you need initiation. First you have to be a disciple. I am not here to waste my time to anybody who passes by and ask any type of question. This is arrogance." It was not arrogance. But that is also the strategy of Segen. Nangaku was a very different kind of master. Nangaku said, "Your question is too arrogant. Why don't you ask modestly?" To which Sekitu replied, "Then it would be better to sink into hell eternally and not ever hope for the liberation that the old saints know. If you call my question arrogant, then I would rather suffer eternally in hell than ask you any question modestly. No question is ever modest. Every question has to be, in a certain way, arrogant. When you are questioning, you are sowing doubt, you are interfering in the silence of the master. Obviously, every question is arrogant. No question can be modest. Only silence is modest. But that is not a question. That is the answer. But Sekitu was really a man with a spine, with guts. He said, "Forget all about the question. I will not ask the question modestly, because no question can be asked modestly. The very question is arrogant. Any question is a doubt. any question is interfering into the energy field of the master. Only silence can be modest. But then I don't have to come to you. I can be silent anywhere. I can be silent even in eternal fire of hell. Sakita is really a man of great intelligence and great courage. Nangaku could not put him down. He was sent especially to Nangaku because he was known to be very harsh, and Sigain wanted to know about Sekito's response, what response he makes to Nangaku. And he really made the right response. He said, forget all about the question. I would rather fall into hell eternally than ask you a question with modesty, because no question is modest, howsoever put. And I have asked it very respectfully. I have called you Osho, my beloved master. And you call my question arrogant. Rather than answering it, you are insulting me. No master insults his disciples. And I am not even a disciple. I am just a stranger, and you are not being nice to me. I am just a guest. You should welcome me. Rather than welcoming me, you are putting me into humiliation. I am not going to ask any question. Sekito, finding that he and Nangaku were not attuned to each other, soon left for Sigain, without giving Nangaku the letter. That man does not deserve even the letter. And he did not stay there, he immediately left. On his arrival, Sigain asked, did they entrust something to you? Sekito said, they did not entrust anything to me. Sigain said, but there must have been a reply. Sekito said, if they don't entrust anything, there is no reply. Then he said, when I was leaving here, you added that I should come back soon to receive the big hatchet under the chair. Now I have come back. Please give me the big hatchet. Sigain was silent. Sekito bowed down and retired. The silence of Sigain was his acceptance of Sekito, his courage. He knew that the letter has not been delivered, there has not been any reply. Although Sekito has not mentioned about letter, he simply said, they did not entrust anything to me, so how there can be any reply? Sigain saw the man that he has the quality and he deserves to be enlightened. His silence was his hatchet. He was saying that when you come, I am going to cut your head with a hatchet. And now he reminded him, now I have come back. Please give me the big hatchet. Cut my head. Do whatsoever you want to do. I am ready. Second verse, silent. Indeed, that deep silence is the transfer, the transmission of the lens. It is not a question of language. It is a question of transfer of energy. Just simply in that silence, the flame jumped from Segen to Sekito. And because he received the flame, the fire, he immediately bowed down and retired. Now there is no need to disturb the master. He has been accepted, not only accepted, he has been delivered the last step for which he had come. Ino was dead before Sekitu became enlightened. In fact, the moment Sekitu left Ino, before he reached to Segen, Ino was dead. He was absolutely aware that death is coming close and Segen is the right person to whom Sekito should be handed over. And he was absolutely correct in his judgment. It was Segen who finally managed Sekito's enlightenment. But enlightenment happens in silence. That's why my whole effort here is to make you as silent as possible. Then you don't need even a Segen. Sitting anywhere in your room, under a tree, in the garden, by the side of the river, anywhere, if your silence deepens, existence itself gives you the initiation into Buddhahood. And when it comes from existence itself directly, it has a far more beauty than when it comes through a master. I teach you immediate sudden enlightenment. The meditation that you are practicing is just preparing you for that great silence in which existence will become a flame inside you. Itsu Zen wrote, falling, but with easy hearts, poppies, the flowers are falling, with easy heart. They are not even looking back to the tree they have been blossoming on, the tree that has been their home for so long, the tree that has been their nourishment for so long. Now they are going back to the earth from where they have come. Falling, but with easy hearts. There is no regret. They enjoyed the sun, they enjoyed the moon, they enjoyed the stars. They dance in the wind, they dance in the rain, they danced, celebrated. What more one needs? It is time to go into eternal rest. That's why their hearts are easy. No tension, no anxiety. They lived totally, they are dying dancingly. They are coming very easily towards the earth, where they will disappear again. They came from the earth, the round is complete, they are going back to the earth. Just as flowers arise from the earth and go back to the earth for eternal rest, you come from existence and you return to existence. If you have an easy heart, then you will not be coming again into the imprisonment of a body. You will simply go back to the very source you have come from, to eternal rest. That eternal rest is nirvana. That eternal rest is moksha. That eternal rest is liberation. That eternal rest is samadhi, truth, enlightenment. Different names for the same experience. You have come back home. And you have come back home dancing with no regret, with no complaint, with easy hearts, peacefully and silently to disappear. This is the most exquisite experience when you are on the verge of disappearing with easy and relaxed heart. A simple and pure let go. Manisha's question. In his book, The Antichrist, Nietzsche states, people who still believe in themselves still also have their own God. In him, they venerate the conditions through which they have prospered, their virtues, they project their joy in themselves. Their feeling of power onto a being whom one can thank for them. Would you like to comment? Manisha. Nietzsche wrote his Antichrist in his insane asylum. But he was such a genius that even though he was declared insane by all psychiatrists, his books prove they were wrong. Even in his insanity, he was far more saner than your so-called sane psychiatrist. Even in his death, he wrote his last letter to a friend. He has not forgotten. He used to write always before making his signature, Antichrist, Friedrich Nietzsche. Even at the moment of death, he has not forgotten to write Antichrist first, then his name. And in that insane asylum, he wrote many things which are of tremendous importance. Antichrist is one of the books that will help you to understand Nietzsche's depth. Although he never went beyond mind, but he managed, even with his mind, to reach to great heights. into great depths. He was Antichrist his whole life, because he said Christ's teachings are humiliation to humanity. Because he calls humanity sheep and calls himself the shepherd. He calls humanity to have committed the original sin, and himself he calls the savior. Just believe in him and he will save you. This is the ultimate insult to anyone who understands. That's why Sekito said, I would rather suffer eternal hell. Then ask the question again to you. We don't fit with each other. There is no harmony between my heart and your heart. My journey to you has been futile. By Antichrist he has many, many things, because his whole teaching is concerned with the Superman. God is dead and man is free to be a Superman. Now he need not be a slave. Now he can declare his freedom. And in his freedom, he will become Superman. With God, he was just a slave. Kneeling down before statues and sculptures and scriptures and praying to God like a beggar, believing in saviors, prophets, messiahs, who were nothing but arch egoists. The whole humanity has been turned into a great spiritual slavery. He was against Christ because he was telling lies. Blessed are the poor, for they shall inherit the kingdom of God. This is a lie. He is simply consoling the poor. And to console the poor is to destroy the revolution possible. If you console the poor, and that's what all the Christians are doing, they are protecting capitalism, they are protecting the people who are in power, and they are giving empty words as consolation to the poor. Blessed are the poor. Nonsense. And just to give them a deeper consolation, he condemns the rich. He says that even if a camel can pass through the eye of a needle, no rich man will ever pass through the gates of paradise. This is just to make the poor feel great. Their poverty is spiritual. It is a gift of God. They are blessed. These people like Jesus have created poverty. And have destroyed the possibility of revolution. Of changing the social structure. Of creating a better society without classes. And finally an ultimate society where the state also withers away. People like Jesus are not the saviors, but consolers. They are functioning, perhaps not knowingly, as agents of the vested interests. That was the reason why he continuously wrote before his signature Antichrist. He was very clear about it. Jesus says, if someone slaps you on one cheek, you give him your another cheek. Nietzsche does not accept it. And I agree with Nietzsche, not with Jesus. The reason? Nietzsche gives a perfect argument for it. He said, if you give another cheek to the person, you are insulting him. You are telling him, I am holier than thou. You are just subhuman. Nobody has seen before Nietzsche that this statement is an insult. That's why I called him an original man. Just missed one thing, meditation. Otherwise, we would have had a greater Buddha than Gautam Buddha himself. Because he would have been absolutely contemporary. Do you understand what he is saying? When you give your other cheek, you are rejecting the man, his humanity. You are saying, I am a saint, and you are just an ordinary human being. Nietzsche says, when somebody hits you on the cheek, hit him as hard as you can. That makes you equal. You accept that man's dignity as a human being, and you also say that I am also a human being. I am not superior than you. I am not holier than you. A strange argument, but absolutely perfect. In this book, The Antichrist, he says, people who still believe in themselves still also have their own God. Now they have become themselves gods. But he does not know anything about meditation. That is the difficulty. In meditation, you enter as if you are a self. But deeper you go, the self starts withering away. When you reach finally to your center, you are no more. The question of being a god does not arise. You are certainly godly, because the whole existence is godly. But it is not a power trip, because power trip needs that others are lower than you and you are higher. In deep meditation, you know, even trees are equal to you. Even animals and birds and rocks are equal to you. The whole existence lives in tremendous equality. That's why I have been saying again and again that only a spiritual, meditative person can be authentically communist and anarchist, nobody else. Because as you go deeper into yourself, you disappear. You are no more. So there is no question of any power trip, any ego number. And the whole existence suddenly becomes just as you are. The ego is absent, the I is absent, only a presence of light, of consciousness, of witnessing. And the whole existence seems to be as silent as you are, as ecstatic as you are. There is no higher, no lower. Both the movements, the movement of communism and the movement of anarchism, have failed in a way because they miss the basic point of equality. Only a meditator knows everything is equal, because we are all part of one organic cosmos. Different shapes and different forms create the beauty because they create variety. But deep down in the roots, it is the same juice, it is the same nourishment that is flowing in the tree, that is becoming a flower, that is flowing in you and becoming a Buddha. Your unfoldment into a Buddha is exactly the unfoldment of a lotus flower. There is no difference at all. Nobody is higher, nobody is lower. Nietzsche is right, if people are not meditative and they drop the idea of God, they themselves become God. Because who will prevent them from becoming gods? Their egos will become absolutely flattened. They will become more and more egoist. God was there, they were humble. They were afraid of punishment, of hell. Now there is no God. Who is going to prevent them from becoming great egos? Napoleon Bonaparte says, when somebody raised the question that it goes against the constitution of the country, what you are doing, he said, I am the law. Throw away the constitution. Whatever I say is constitution. Now this is bound to happen. The egoist people become the very law. The egoist people will become gods. Hirohito has died in Japan. Second World War has been such a shock to the Japanese people. Not because of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but because of the defeat of the sun god. They have been believing that their emperor is a sun god. He is not human being. He cannot be defeated. And he has been defeated for the first time in the whole history. Because he was never defeated, the concept continued and became more and more ingrained that he cannot be defeated. There is no power which can defeat him. He is no more human being. He is a god, sun god. The great shock to the Japanese people was the defeat of Hirohito. Because for the first time they could not believe, they were confused. Sun god is defeated by ordinary human beings. But all great kings and emperors have believed that they share power with God. If there is no God, your kings, your emperors, the people who have power will start thinking that we are gods. and everybody else is just ordinary human beings. So he is right if you are not acquainted with meditation. Mind is a dangerous phenomenon. Without God, it can become very inflated. It can start thinking about itself as being the God. I am reminded of a beautiful incident. It happened in Baghdad, a Mohammedan country and capital. In the times of a certain Khalif, Umar, a man declared that he has come with a new message from God, and it is far more improved than the Holy Quran. He was immediately caught and brought to Khalif Umar into his court, that this man is proclaiming that he is coming from God and he has brought a new message to humanity, more refined than Muhammad's Holy Quran. Mohammedans cannot accept any refinement on Holy Quran. That is the last word of God. Every religion says so. Mahavir is the last word. Nothing can be changed, nothing can be refined. So is the Buddha. The last word for the Buddhists. So is Jesus. So is Moses. Every founder in the world has tried that I am the final, full stop. Everything stops with me, no more evolution. But evolution does not care about these people. It goes on and on. Umar was very much angry. He said, "You are a Mohammedan and you are claiming that you are a better prophet than Muhammad?" He said, "Of course, because I am coming after so many centuries. The world has changed, the time has changed, it needs a new Holy Quran. I have brought it." Umar was very angry. He told his soldiers, "Give him good treatment. Bind him naked in a pillar in the prison and beat him for 7 days. Don't allow him to sleep and no food. And after 7 days, I will come and see whether he changes his mind or not." He was tortured for 7 days continuously, no sleep, no food, and continuous beating. When 7th day, Umar reached in the jail, the man was simply full of blood. All whole body was oozing blood. Umar asked, "What do you think now? Have you changed your mind or not?" The man laughed. He said, "When I was coming from paradise, taking the new message to humanity, God has told me that you will be tortured. Every prophet has been tortured. So these 7 days have proved completely that I am the prophet." God was right. Umar could not believe his eyes. And at that moment, suddenly from another pillow, from another pillar, a man was brought 1 month before, and Umar has completely forgotten about him. He used to declare, "I am God himself." So he has been in the jail, tortured for 1 month, and because Umar has completely forgotten him, he had become interested in this prophet. Suddenly that man shouted, "Umar, beware, after Muhammad, I have never sent any prophet in the world. This man is lying. I am God." What to do with these people? Just insane. No psychoanalyst can say that Jesus is sane. If he is true to his scientific analysis and scientific approach. The man is calling himself the Son of God. He needs hospitalization. He does not need crucifixion. That is absolutely wrong. He is not committing any crime. He is simply declaring his insanity. And you don't put insane people on the cross. You have compassion on them. They need psychiatric treatment. But unfortunately, there was no psychiatry and no psychology. It waited for another Jew to invent it. That was Sigmund Freud. But he came too late, 2000 years afterwards, when the first Jew, Jesus, was crucified. It is really megalomania. If God is not there, there is every possibility anybody who has an egoistic mind is bound to move to the other extreme. First he was kneeling down before God. Now, knowing there is no God, he moves to the other extreme. Now he declares, "I am God." God has to be there. But this is the experience of only one who knows the mind and not anything beyond it. As you move beyond the mind, you are no more. There is no one to declare that I am the Son of God or I am God. There is no one to declare that I am the Savior of mankind or I am a prophet or I am a reincarnation of God. All these people are simply insane. And you have been worshipping insane people because they declared themselves to be God. All these so-called founders of religion needed psychiatric treatment. There are still people, when Jawaharlal Nehru was the first Prime Minister of India, there were at least 1 dozen people all over India who believed they are Jawaharlal Nehru. One person I knew. Because he used to live in a nearby town, and I used to go there once in a while to lecture in that town's college. And there I met him, because he had come to the lecture. And the principal laughingly introduced me that here is Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, our Prime Minister. And he was dressed exactly like Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru. He looks like Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru. The man said, looks, I am. And the principal letter on told me that this man goes on giving telegrams to government circuit houses that the Prime Minister is coming on such and such date, so keep the best room for him. He will be staying for 2 days and inform all the officials. And many times he has deceived, because in a small village nobody knows Jawaharlal Nehru directly. They have only seen his pictures, and that man was completely dressed. He had the same hairstyle, the same cap, the same basket, the same Mohammedan style pajama. Everything perfect, and a little bit because of his mind, perhaps, his face was also becoming similar to Jawaharlal Nehru. He believed it absolutely. There was no doubt about it. He behaved the way Jawaharlal behaved. He walked the way Jawaharlal walked. But he was never caught, because he died in a car accident. One man in the biggest madhouse in India, in Rae Bareli, used to think that he is Jawaharlal Nehru, was forced in the madhouse. He lived for 3 years and finally recognized that he is not. Perhaps the torture, perhaps the continuous hammering on his mind that you are not, he became tired. That's my feeling, because what happened later on proves my feeling right. Jawaharlal Nehru was going to come to Rae Bareli for some celebration. And the officers thought that now he is cured, it will be a good opportunity. Jawaharlal is going to come to the madhouse also to open a new wing which has newly constructed for more mad people to be accommodated. So it will be good to give him a release from Jawaharlal's own hands. So they waited. It was only a question of a week. And when Jawaharlal came, they brought the madman. They introduced him that, this is Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru, our Prime Minister. The man looked at Jawaharlal Nehru and he said, don't be worried. It will take 3 years at least. I used to think exactly the same as you think. But these people are such torturers. Finally, I had to accept that I am not, although I know I am. In 3 years' time, you will also accept you are not. Just get in. I am going. I am going out. You get in. Don't be worried. It takes only 3 years to be cured. Jawaharlal could not understand what to do with this man. And he was perfectly logical. He used to think, and these people have cured him by torturing him. But deep down he knows who he is. It happened in England when Churchill was the Prime Minister. Because of the Second World War in London,
after 6 o'clock, there was curfew. And very strict curfew. Nobody should be seen outside their houses. Otherwise, he has to be sought. There was no question of any inquiry. Churchill used to go for an evening walk, and that day it was such a beautiful sunset, which is very rare in England. Sun arises only once in a while. So he went on sitting on a park bench watching the beautiful sunset. And he forgot about the curfew. Suddenly, as the sun went down the horizon, he realized that he is late. The time is already past. He should have been inside the house, and it was still at least 1 mile away. And the strict orders, his orders were, anybody seen out of the house after 6 o'clock has to be sought. He will be sought. He just looked wherever he can enter in any house, and anybody will give him shelter, knowing that he is Winston Churchill, our Prime Minister, our Savior. So he knocked on the first house. It happened to be a madhouse. A man opened the door and he said, "I am sorry to disturb you. I am Winston Churchill. You must have known about me. I am the Prime Minister of England." That man simply grabbed him. He said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Shut up. Here are already 6 Winston Churchills. Come in." He said, "I say to you, I am really Winston Churchill." He said, "Don't say anything. They all say the same thing. And I am putting you with them. You will know who is real." There was no way to go out. There was the danger of being shot dead. It is better to rest in this madhouse. And he was put with those 6 fat guys, smoking the same kind of cigar as Churchill, you see, always smoking wherever he is. And when the 7th Churchill entered, they all waved him victory sign. "Welcome, guy, come in." He signed, "This is a strange place." They all look like him. They are fat and puffed up and smoking cigar and giving him the victory sign. He tried hard. The whole night the discussion went on. He told them that you people are mad. "I am the real." They all laughed. He said, "Everybody here is real. Unreal churches don't exist." Churchill cried that, "Don't you recognize me?" They said, "Don't you recognize us? We are very happy to have you. 6 are already here. You are the 7th. More will be coming. But all are real. Nobody is unreal." In the morning, this whole tortured night with those 6 churches continuously smoking and talking the way Churchill used to talk about all war affairs and programs, how to defeat the Hitler. And Churchill was silent, what to do with these idiots. And they used to nag him that, why you are sitting silently? If you are a real Churchill, come in and discuss with us problems of the country. The country is in danger and you are sitting silently. And you think you are real Churchill. Churchill said later on that once in a while in the night I had a doubt that if these people are so certain, who knows? Maybe I am mad because I am also certain. There is no difference. They are certain, I am certain. They seem to be more absolutely certain than me. I sometimes have the hesitation that maybe. In the morning he phoned to the Parliament House that send people to convince this jailer. And they were all wondering, because the whole night he has been searched all over London, where he has gone. Because the whole England was dependent on Churchill's methodology to defeat Adolf Hitler. Where he is gone? Is it some conspiracy of Adolf Hitler that he has abducted him? So when he phoned, immediately people came and told the jailer that you are an idiot. You tortured our Prime Minister. He said, you just come in and you see there are seven. I am not at fault. They all say the same thing. And this man was also saying the same thing. How I am to decide who is real? You come in. And when those people came in, they could not believe their eyes. They said, you are right. We are sorry. But this man is the real Churchill. We are taking him out. And they were higher officials and the parliamentarians. So the janitor agreed. Those six others said, what is the matter? That phony fellow has been taken out. And we are real Churchills, not one, six. And nobody takes any care. It has been an experience in many countries. Ego is insane. If there is no God, the egoist can think of himself as God. But this can happen only if you are not acquainted with meditation. Meditation simply dissolves you into the cosmos. You are no more, only the existence is. This is time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh. A new young priest, Father Fever, has just arrived at the Holy Saints of Sackcloth Monastery. After a couple of weeks, he is feeling so disturbed by sexual fantasies that he goes to see the Father Superior, old Father Fornicate, aged 95. Ah, Father, cries Fever, I am deeply troubled by impure thoughts and sexual temptations come crowding into my mind. Things like doggy style and 69, French ticklers and satin panties with pictures of Jesus on them. The more I try to resist them, the more they crowd into my mind. Says Father Fornike, adjusting his robe. So what would you like to know? Well, replies Father Fever, perspiring, you are 95 years old and one of the most ancient relics of the church. Tell me, how old do you have to be before you are released from the lusts of the flesh? Says Father Fornicate, eyeing the young priest, it takes many years of self-torture and holy prayer before your mind is cleaned of all such wickednesses. Really? Ask the young priest, how many years? Well, replies old Fornicate with a sigh, I can tell you that it is more than 95. Newton Hooton gets into Dingle Dilda's New York taxi to go across town and finds himself being thrown around inside the car as Dingle races through the street. Hey, slow down, shouts Newton when he finally manages to catch hold of something, or you will get us both into hospital. You don't need to worry, mister, replies Dingle. I have just got out of hospital after being there for 18 months and I don't intend going back. I am sorry, says Newton, feeling reassured. You were in hospital for 18 months? That must have been awful. Were you badly injured? No, not a scratch, replies Dingle. It was a mental hospital. Peter Pumper gets onto the famous TV game show Primal Passions and wins his way to the final round. Okay, Mr. Pumper, says Monty Mount, the MC, for the big $64,000 question. Which subject do you choose? I choose sexual techniques, replies Peter excitedly. Good, shouts Monty, and in addition, you are allowed to choose any expert to help you answer the questions. I have brought with me the famous French sexologist, André Pervers, replies Peter Pumper confidently. The audience gasps with approval. Right, shouts Monty. Now enter in the soundproof box together and prepare to answer the big question on sexual techniques. You have exactly 1 minute to answer. The question is, you are in bed with your mistress and you have exactly 3 kisses to arouse her to the max. Where would you place the first kiss? On the lips, cries Peter, without a second's hesitation. Correct, shouts Monty. And where would you place the second kiss? There is a pause as Peter thinks for a moment, but then he shouts, on the back of the neck. Correct, shouts Monty. The audience howls with approval. Now, continues Monty, for the third and final part of the question, for $64,000, where would you place the third kiss? perspiration pours down Peter's face. He is in trouble. As the music plays louder and louder, and time ticks away, in desperation Peter turns to his partner, Andre Perverse, and says, "Andre, you must help me." But the Frenchman shakes his head frantically. "Do not ask me, mon ami," replies Andre. "In my mind, I have already been wrong twice." Never know. Close your eyes and feel your bodies to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to turn in. Gather all your energies, your total consciousness, and with an urgency, as if this is going to be the last moment of your life, rush towards your very center of being. Faster and faster, deeper and deeper. As you come closer to your very center, a great silence descends over you. It is falling like soft rain. A little more closer, and a totally new experience, flowers of peace, flowers of serenity, flowers of absolute tranquility are growing all around you. Just one step more and you are at the very center of your being. Absolutely drunk with the divine, surrounded by an aura of ecstasy, you are facing your original face for the first time. The face of the Buddha is just a symbol. It is really everybody's face, the ultimate face. The only quality the Buddha has, all the Buddhas, past, present, future, are bound to have only one quality, witness, awareness. Just witness. You are not the body. Witness, you are not the mind. And witness, you are only a witness. You are just a Buddha, utterly innocent,
beyond mind, a pure space, infinite and eternal. To make your witnessing deeper, Nivedana, relax, let go, the same way as the flowers fall down from the trees with easy heart, no tension, no anxiety. Settled at the center, you are in tune with existence. Your heartbeat is the heartbeat of the whole universe. This moment, you are the most blessed people on the earth, because there is no other splendor in existence greater than you are in this moment. Rejoice this beautiful moment. Rejoice this authentic and original experience. Rejoice that you are so blessed to be so close to existence itself, and gather all these experiences before Nivedana calls you back. You have to bring them from the center to the circumference of your life. You have to live a life of grace, beauty, joy, blissfulness, ecstasy, in every moment around the clock, whether awake or asleep. You are the Buddha, and all that belongs to Buddha, the witnessing, the ecstasy, the rejoicing, the blissfulness, the utter drunkenness that comes to you when you reach to your center, you have reached to the very center of existence. You are drowned in the juices of life and nourished. Collect all this experience and remember that you have to persuade the Buddha to come with you. These are the three steps of meditation. First, the Buddha comes behind you as a shadow, but the shadow is fragrant. The shadow has tremendous solidity. The shadow is not shadow, but the presence, very tangible. You can touch it. You can feel it. It is almost behind you. Its warmth, its compassion, its light will all be sovereign on you. The second step, you become the shadow and Buddha comes in front of you. Your shadow slowly fades away, because your personality is nothing but a false idea, an imagination, a fiction, a lie. And as your shadow disappears, your being becomes one with the Buddha. That is the third and the final step.
The moment you become the Buddha, you have come back home. That day will be the most fortunate day of all your lives. You have lived for many lives, in many ways, in many bodies, and you have been missing and missing and missing. This time, make it clear to yourself, you are not going to miss. You have to become enlightened. You have to achieve the highest peak and the deepest depth of your being. This is the very purpose of me calling your hidden secret, your hidden splendor to the surface. God is dead. Now only Zen is the living truth. Nivedana, come back, but very slowly, very peacefully, very silently, as if there is no one in the auditorium. Just sit silently for a few seconds to remember the path you have followed, to remember all that great space, those beautiful moments when your heart was in tune with the heart of the universe. Those few rare moments when your whole life was eternal. And feel the Buddha, his warmth, his compassion, his presence. It is just behind you. The day is not far away. You will take the second step and you will take the third step. These 10,000 people are going to become 10,000 Buddhas in their own right.
The responses to sutras and voice recording on this audio format are the copyright of Osho International Foundation. Copyright dates 1953 through 2003. All rights reserved. Reproduction in any media is prohibited.